tell me about your mother and father.
Well, my mother wanted me to be a locksmith. Maybe that was her conception of science. I don't know, my mother and father, my father was a druggist, and my mother was also a druggist, that's how they met. So they were not educated in the modern sense of the word, but they were very educated people. We read a lot, and my father bought books on an auction in Copenhagen, and we got this big wooden crates of books, which we gleefully opened. But there were basically only garbage books in there because you buy them at an auction. But I remember when, before I started school, I learned to read in Danish because there were Tarzan books in there.
What was it like for you when you went to school?
Well, we are talking now about ancient times. And I went to a little school out in the country, and there was one teacher going to take care of free classes, the first free classes. So then we went twice a week, because that's all she could do. The next 4 years, we had two teachers taking care of the classes, so then we went twice a week. So for the first seven years...
So you mean you only went to school two times a week?
For the first three grades. The next 4 grades, we went twice a week. And the most important subject was religion, because religion was a state religion, still is a state religion in Norway. So we had to sort of learn the New Testament, at least, by heart. I think it was just 3 or 4 people in my class of 20 who went to secondary school. My parents believed in education, and they also were better off than this was a small village in the country where a lot of poor people.
And what did you go on to study after high school?
Well, I always wanted to be an engineer, and so I applied to the only one engineering school in Norway at that time anyway. And I applied there, and to get in, you have to have very good grades. And I wanted to become an electrical engineer, but I had a B in French, and I couldn't then, according to the rules of the game, you could not be an electrical engineer with a B in French. I also couldn't be a chemical engineer with a B in French, so I had to be satisfied with a mechanical engineer. I was not a very industrious student, to say the least, and the reason for that was that grades as a mechanical engineer was not very important, because normally in Norway, if you have a mechanical engineer, you will keep a little factory running, so you need common sense and sort of be a practical person, but you don't have to have any mathematical knowledge, because in Norway, that time and now, they don't make any cars, they don't make any airplanes, they don't make any watches, they don't make any mobile phones. They basically don't make anything. And so therefore, you know, you're not going to, you know, do great mechanical engineering in Norway. Then I wanted to get the job in Norway, which even though with my bad grades, that was very easy. But there were no apartment or housing to get. You just simply was unavailable. This was in 1952 or 53. And because of the lack of housing, my wife and I decided we're going to emigrate. And when we made that decision, we emigrated to Canada, because that only took like 3 weeks to get a visa. Going to the United States at that time took over a year.
So what happened?
Well, eventually I got a job and I survived. So in Canada, I walked from door to door to try to get a job. That was also very educational for me, but I wasn't used to that. So I went and knocked on doors and tried to get a job and tried to present myself. And it was a shock, because coming from Norway, I had been led to believe that the Norwegian engineering school was the absolute best in the world. But when you look for a job in Toronto, Canada, they say, oh, you're from Norway. Is that part of Sweden someplace? So, you know, you recognize that what you have learned as a child is not necessarily true when you come out in the big world. And I remember I had a big chance of getting a job once with Canadian Packers. And so I talked to the guy, and they liked me, and everything looked good. But then he asked, what would you like to do when you get here? And I had no idea what Canadian Packers was doing, so I was stuck. But it's actually a meat packing firm, you know. But I didn't know that, so, you know, I thought maybe they made watches or something. What could you do? So I flubbed it and I didn't get the job.
It strikes me that at this point, you're in no way knowing much about nuclear physics or quantum physics or electrons in transition states and so on. At this point, your head is full of engineering. Is that correct or have I got it wrong?
No, I was a mechanical engineer with very little theoretical knowledge at that time. I knew nothing about quantum mechanics, nothing about physics, nothing about electrons.
And you're what kind of age at this point?
What kind of what?
Age. How old?
I was, when I got to Canada, I was probably like 25, 26 years old.
So then what happened?
Well, I was very fortunate because General Electric, first of all, is a big company. People don't recognize how big company is. General Electric's sale is probably bigger than the gross national product of Norway. Actually, it is bigger. So it's more important to be a president of General Electric than to be the king of Norway. It's a much more important job. And General Electric had this idea at that time to train their engineers, because at that time, engineers normally did not get a PhD degree. And General Electric thought that the engineers didn't know enough. So they had what they called a test program. And that was absolutely golden for me, because I recognized that in Canada, or in the United States as well, your luck really depends on you to a large extent, that you got to really work for it.
How long after this did you start getting involved in the work for which you got the Nobel Prize, the tunneling work?
It was basically 1960, and when I started at the General Electric Research Lab. And I had a very nice mentor named John Fisher, and he was the one who led me into what became the Nobel Prize.
I need to understand how somebody who knows no wave mechanics is not somebody who's gone through years of solving quantum mechanic equations comes to get a Nobel Prize for tunneling.
Well, see, life is not fair, and I'm very happy that life is not fair. You know, so that's a good thing for me. See, when I got the job at the General Electric Company at the research lab, John Fisher said, "I'm going to work with thin films." That's what he said. And then I went to Norway for 2 months, and I thought thin films meant films in a camera. So I took some books in photography, which I read in Norway, which was absolutely of no use when I got back. Because John Fisher meant we should work with metal films, and if you put two metal films very close together, you can get electron flowing from one film to the other, which is known as quantum mechanical tunneling. And when John told me about that, I just didn't believe it. And when I'm a very skeptical person, and anytime people tell me something, I just don't believe it. So anyway, he said that the electrode could go through even though they would have a negative kinetic energy, so to speak, in the middle of the barrier. As a mechanical engineer, even a bad one in theory doesn't really believe that. So I started out saying, I'm really going to do this and I'm going to show that it doesn't work. But at the same time, I was taking quantum mechanical courses at the university I'm at now, Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute. And so I took courses there and I learned about tunneling. And in theoretically. And then it turns out that I managed to get this system we did to work, so I could see that I had tunneling. And then I gave a talk at the lab, and I was very nervous. I gave a talk, I tell you, it was the toughest talk I'd given. And people were very polite, and I told them I had tunneled from one metal to the other and stuff, and they were polite and nice people. But I could tell from their attitude that I didn't believe I'd seen tunneling. They thought maybe I had hole in the oxide films, or ion current flowing, or maybe semiconducting current. So they were sort of skeptical. And then I decided, you know, so that bothered me, of course. And then I decided to then you spend really all your waking time thinking about how you can make an experiment which absolutely clinches that this is tunneling. And so that's what I did for many, many months. And I had all sorts of crazy ideas. None of them worked, really. And then at the same time, I took a course at Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute by a very nice man called Hill Huntington. And we talked the solid state physics course. And he came to superconductivity in a course. Then he said, in superconductors, they have no resistance. So being a skeptical person, I didn't believe that. I thought maybe they have a tiny little bit of resistance, but they couldn't really measure it, and this sort of thing. But then he said to me, which was the thing, is that there's a new theory called Bardeen-Cooper-Schrieffer theory, and there is an energy gap in superconductors. And when he said that word, right away I got the idea for, and what is the reason I'm sitting here talking to you today. So I got that idea in Hill Huntington's class. And I recognized if I, rather than have a metal on one side, had a metal which was superconducting, I would see a particular bump in the curve. And that bump would prove that I had really observed tunneling. I got the idea in class, and I went back to the General Electric Research Lab, which was a wonderful place at that time. And I had one of my best friends is Charlie Bean, and was Walter Harrison and John Fisher. These were the three people I interacted most.